This episode of The Imposter is brought to you by HelloFresh, the meal kit service dedicated to making cooking fun, easy, and convenient. HelloFresh works with chefs from around the world to come up with delicious recipes that you can make with the fresh, local produce that they deliver to your door every week. If you want to try it out for a week, you can get 50% off by going to HelloFresh.ca/TheImposter and entering Imposter at checkout. This episode is also brought to you by Second City, which is the largest school for improv and sketch comedy in the world. But their classes are intimate and personalized, and they range from low-commitment drop-ins for dilettantes to intensives for people who want to go deep. You can take a look at their classes and find one that works for you at secondcity.com/TC. I grew up in a pretty hosiery place, and I don't really have an accent from that place.
We can help you. it's a tight lips. You just got to have your lips really tight.
Yeah?
Try it. Oh, well, I don't know.
Oh, I don't think, know.
Yeah, you're getting there. Just keep them tight.
I don't know.
Oh, not bad. And then lower your jaw, like tight lip. It's a kind of a contrast. Lower your jaw and tighten the lips. Yeah, like, hey, how's it going? Try that one.
Hey, how's it going?
Not bad. Pretty deadly.
From Canada Land, this is The Imposter, and I'm Aliyah Pabani. We all know what a hoser is. It's a slang word that refers to a Canadian. You know the stereotype. It's the kind of beer-drinking, hockey-playing moron that drives a snowmobile onto the ice before it's frozen enough not to break. But the thing is, we don't really know what a hoser is. For one thing, we don't know where the word comes from. One theory is that it comes from a hockey tradition where the losing team would hose down the rink to resurface it. Another one is that it comes from the prairies, where farmers would use a hose to siphon gas from other farmers' vehicles during the Great Depression. Some of the theories are simpler. To get hosed is vintage slang for getting drunk, and a hoser is someone who does that. But according to a lexicographer named Stefan Dolinger, who spent the past 11 years updating and revising the Dictionary of Canadianisms on historical principles, the first written instance of the word hoser was in 1981. It's from a Toronto Star article about this recurring sketch on SCTV. It was about this fictional TV show called The Great White North, and it was hosted by Rick Moranis and Dave Thomas, who played two Canadian brothers named Bob and Doug McKenzie.
Good day and welcome to The Great White North. I'm Doug McKenzie.
No, that's my
brother,
job,
Bob.
Every segment would start the same way, with some asinine topic like donut shop parking lots or twist-off caps. Or, one of my favorite Canadian inventions, a giant robotic arm for space missions.
So, like, I want to know, is like the Canadians made like the space arm for the shuttle, eh? Well, I'd like to know, like, can you use it to open a beer? And can you use it to hold the beer and then, like, bring it up to your mouth? I figure if it was designed in Canada, it's got to be able to open a beer, which means those guys that go up there, the astronauts, are, like, having a beauty time up there with that arm.
Okay, like, now you tell me.
Bob and Doug McKenzie were the first hosers on TV, and they gained a cult following that spread to the U.S. When NBC began airing the show, they specifically mentioned getting good audience feedback on the, quote, two dumb Canadian characters. But Bob and Doug McKenzie were never meant to just be two dumb Canadian characters. When SCTV moved to the CBC, the show had to be extended by 2 minutes, and the CBC asked the producers to make content that was identifiably Canadian for that 2 minutes. Rick and Dave thought it was absurd, given that the show was made in Canada with a mostly Canadian cast and crew. So they created the brothers not as a parody of Canadians. but as a way to drag the network's CanCon requirements. They phoned it in. The two of them would sit alone in the studio drinking actual beers and frying up actual back bacon, and they would pump out a bunch of half-baked segments, some of which would end up on air. In an interview about it, Dave Thomas said, "It was all very low-key and stupid, and we thought, well, they get what they deserve. This is their Canadian content. I hope they like it." But Bob and Doug McKenzie ended up becoming the most popular segment on SCTV. Here's arts and culture writer John Zemley.
You can look at that in a way and say, like, oh, Canadians are stupid and we just love these sort of like base representations of ourselves. But I actually think in a way the opposite is true, which is that we can only really laugh at ourselves when we're laughing at the idea of laughing at ourselves. You're sort of mocking the notion that there's even something to make fun of or that we're even worthy of parody. So when we mock the idea that we're trying to be funny, it becomes actually funny. I sound like a stoned undergrad right now, like I'm totally aware of that.
The thing is, for most of us, we're not watching with that level of distance and irony. The segments don't feel like some meta commentary on Canadian broadcasting. It just seems like you're watching a couple of hammy comedians that your dad was really into. But the reason why Bob and Doug have become iconic is that there's something both recognizable and vague about them. So you can identify with them, and at the same time, you can say, that's not me. And maybe it also kind of feels flattering that there is something about Canadian culture that's worthy of imitation. Their success created a sort of archetype for the hoser character, which laid the foundation for decades of hosers from Red Green to the Trailer Park Boys to Letterkenny. The Bob and Doug of my generation were a couple of bangers named Terry and Diener.
Let's get her fucking going! Woo!
In the early aughts, a low-budget mockumentary called FUBAR debuted at Sundance. It was about these two hard-partying headbangers from Alberta named Terry and Dean, who are being followed around by a documentary filmmaker character named Farrell while they drink beer, break shit, and attempt to deal with Dean's testicular cancer diagnosis. They've got the same kind of generic, regional Canadian accent and kindly ignorance as Bob and Doug, but the film's built around their interactions with real people who don't seem to fully recognize that they're in character. Here's John Zemley again.
I think the first film was so successful largely because it's, you know, heavily improvised. It feels very loose and shaggy. It almost feels like a sort of like crude Christopher Guest film or something like that, where these guys are so inside these characters. I think it sort of took Bob and Doug McKenzie and like made it realer. Like these, again, these are guys that you might have like known in high school or from your small town or whatever. You know, like Bob and Doug McKenzie would walk into a bar and you know that they're doing a shtick or whatever.
FUBAR became a cult hit across North America when I was in high school. And everyone around me wasn't only quoting it, but trying to become the characters. Suddenly, there were all these middle-class kids of doctors and lawyers who were growing hockey hair, wearing weird crop tops and aviators, and even though they were shotgunning beers before, it seemed more theatrical now. But for some reason, I never watched it. I just wasn't curious about Terry and Diener. I was surrounded by people like this, like white people from small towns who did what they wanted and never got in trouble for it. But it's become a cult classic. And I wanted to get a sense of what it meant at the time. So I talked to two people who saw it when it first came out, in cities that might as well have been shooting locations for the film.
My name's Carla. I'm on the cusp of Scorpio and Sagittarius, and I live in Sudbury. I think I saw the first one when I was a lot younger, and I could just be like, yeah, I've totally done stupid stuff like that. I can totally relate to being pushed around in a shopping cart, because I mean, who hasn't been pushed around and wasted in a shopping cart? You know what I mean? But I remember, because my husband is not Canadian, when he first got here, it was kind of something that I wanted to show him, to sort of introduce him to my people. I don't think he was really into it. He just didn't find it funny. And he was just like, I don't understand the point of this. And he turned it off. Maybe it's a cultural thing. I don't know. Or maybe we're just two completely different people.
My name is Shelly Zhang, and I'm an artist and arts administrator in Toronto.
First time I saw FooBar was when I was in my early teens, and at that time I was living in Windsor, Ontario, which is the city right across from Detroit. At that age, I was kind of hanging out with people who are more involved in the punk scene in Windsor. Looking back at it, I was probably the only person of color in that group. There's a lot of parallels between the people who are in FooBar. You know, some of the people that I was hanging around with, they come from more industrial sort of backgrounds. They had family ties in like the auto industry. And around that time, it was sort of where the concern was that GM was gonna go under and whatnot. So I think this was sort of a something in a way that was sort of light, where it could be comedy that you could sort of watch to get over things that were really real at the time.
Hearing from people broke FooBar open a bit. I wanted to know what the inspiration was for this particular version of the Hoser and what made it so funny, but also so identifiable for some people. And because FooBar is a franchise now, if I wanted to understand it, I had to watch FooBar, FooBar 2, Balls to the Wall, and their new series from Viceland, FooBar, Age of Computer. The problem was that in all the interviews I watched with Terry and Dean, they would show up in character. And that meant that the interviewer would be stuck in this horrible in-between state of trying to improvise with them while frantically trying to bring them back to the question line. It's terrifying to look at. It's like watching someone in the process of drowning with an expression that's inappropriately serene. I wanted to talk to them, but I didn't want to improvise and I didn't want to drown. Luckily, they showed up as Paul Spence and Dave Lawrence, not Terry and Diener. The one person who did kind of show up in character was the director, Mike Douse, who is playing a famous director who keeps stepping out for important calls.
Yes, hi, my name is Michael.
Hi. Well, this is Dave and Paul. I mean, we could summon Terry and
Well,
Diener
you're Dave, I'm Paul.
I'm Dave, he's Paul.
Okay.
But I'm also the Diener sometimes.
Right.
And you're also Terry sometimes.
Right on.
Okay, so don't take this the wrong way, but why did you make FooBar?
Oh, well, I mean, I can say I made it because there was very little. There was a little bit of work in Calgary for actors. You might get your day player because American Productions coming through, and met Mike on another film, and I was like, let's make our own movie, just because it felt like the right thing to do instead of like trying to like get a few more lines on a big production.
Mm-hmm.
It also felt like a lot of people waited to raise a lot of money to make films, and we just felt like we had an idea that worked for low budget, and let's just go shoot it. And there was also kind of not a lot of really funny Canadian movies, which we found surprising, or I found surprising, given how many funny Canadians there are. And there was a lot of sort of art house movies that were coming out of Canada at that time, and I was really interested in making something that was just purely funny.
Mm.
And we sort of had the characters all set to go, so.
Yeah.
Can you talk to me about how those characters came to be? Like, what was Patient Zero of?
So it started at the Loose Moose Theater Company in Calgary, which is an improvisation-based company.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to just do this format of improvisation called theater sports, competitive improvisation, team on team, like challenging each other to different improv games. And in one tournament, we started this team called White Trash, which was headbangers trying to improvise. Because it was a lot of fun, just like doing it poorly, kind of having fun working the characters. And so that's sort of where it started. I wasn't the first banger. There were other performers at
Dave,
Loose
you
Moose.
Were Patient Zero. And I would say Loose Moose was the orangutan.
Yeah.
Yeah, as far as, you know, diving deep into the sort of creation of these characters, I mean, for me personally, I can only speak to myself, but I mean, it was really just a matter of putting on the accent of, you know, the sort of working man the sort of northeast part of Calgary where I would work, you know, cutting grass and stuff. And, you know, there's a guy that I used to work with, you know, named Wayne. And, you know, he had a, you know, those like those long gas powered sort of grass cutting things. Mm-hmm. And he painted his white and called it Excalibur. And he had super long hair and he had a mustache. And it was, you know, and he was just a character. You know what I mean? He just, the very fact that every time he opened his mouth, you were kind of suppressing a laugh. You know what I mean? He was just that guy, right? And so that was more or less who I was basing my character on, just sort of a, kind of like a drunken version of myself.
Okay.
You know? And that guy, yeah, Wayne, that was kind of it.
So you guys were both at Loose Moose doing these characters?
I didn't really do Dean that much at Loose Moose. Dave was doing Terry a lot, and then he invited me to come back. I was living in Montreal at the time. He invited me to come back to Calgary and be in this movie that he wanted to do. And then we kind of had to create Dean. You know, Dean kind of had to be birthed. And it was just kind of like, Terry needs a buddy.
So we did a stage play called Terry and His Buddy Dean. We did 4 shows about a month before we shot the film. Just okay. to kind of like, you know, work the character a bit.
Mm. And what was the thought about who the character should be as opposed to Terry?
Yeah, that's a good question, actually, that people don't really ask. I knew that Terry was kind of like your he already had his look down,
yeah,
right? And so it started with like he was the sweatpants guy, the guy with like this t-shirt that's too short, you know, that's been cropped.
Yeah.
He was wearing kind of like yellow safety glasses and a hat, right? That was kind of Terry's look. So the other sort of the other side of the banger spectrum, if you will, was the kind of black jeans, black leather jacket, you know, the kind of like pseudo tough guy.
Yeah.
So I just kind of went with that. And the I mean, it was, I remember going to the pawn shop and the jacket was sitting in the window. And it was just like, there's Dean. There's my black leather jacket. And yeah, black leather high tops. And yeah, that was pretty much it.
Right. And Terry's kind of like he's got like a sweetness or like a naivete to him.
Mm-hmm.
And Diener is a bit of an ass.
More yeah, an yeah, yeah, definitely. Self-involved, doesn't think of anyone but himself.
Right.
Definitely a bit of a jerk. Yeah.
Did you hang out with bangers to like develop the characters at all, or is this like a scene that you're already in?
Yeah, definitely. Like sort of, I previously referenced the guy that I worked with.
The guys that you work with.
Maintenance crew. I worked the Calgary Stampede. We both worked at the Calgary Stampede on the riots with the carnies.
Okay,
and that was pretty insightful. And the year before we got hired, you know, these kind of rough dudes were working all the rides, the adult rides and the kids rides. And so that year, the Stampede is like, why don't we put some younger, like, teenagers with these rough guys for the kids section? Just so the kids are like...
So the parents are like, like, oh, okay, well, there's a teenager around. Obviously, the creep factor has been reduced.
And so those were the guys
that... Have they met teenagers?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. In retrospect, it seems like a horrible, horrible clash of ideologies.
Like, teenagers with, like, a speed board for a spinning ride with, like, five-year-olds is, like, supposed to be reassuring to parents.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it was
The Berry-Go-Round?
Yeah, I worked the
And the
Avalanche.
The Convoy. No, we worked in the kids' lands.
Oh, yeah. Right.
We never got on the kids' big ones. Rides. But hanging out with those guys, the carnies, they like just this. The guy I really remember was from Kentucky, and I had never met someone like that. And maybe the inspiration for Terry's big yellow glasses is he had giant, huge glasses. And I remember, at like, kind of timid, I was like, "Where'd you get those?" And he's like, "Prison." And I was like, "Okay." I'm gonna step back a tiny bit and go back to my berry and like open it up.
I mean, the guy that I worked with on the convoy, he literally lived. He didn't live in a trailer. He lived in like a rectangle underneath the trailer.
Oh.
Like, that's where his bed. That's where his house was. He didn't have a kitchen or anything. He literally had basically the size of a coffin, and that was like he lived there.
It's like a drawer to sleep in.
And these guys,
a drawer, exactly.
All they ate was fair food. Carnival food,
man.
And I remember that, like, I was 16 years old, this first long job where I was working 12-hour days, and my mom would pick me up from the Stampede and drop me off, and I told her about this guy I was working with that all he ate was corn dogs and soda, and and my mom one day brought a plate of spaghetti for him, and he like wolfed it down, and at first he's like, "That's the best thing I've ever had," and then he got super sick from my mom's spaghetti, and he was just cursing it for like the next 5 days. He's like, "Shouldn't eat your mom's spaghetti." Like, it screwed up his guts because his flora was all like corn dog and sweets.
He couldn't handle it. Good thing she didn't bring like a salad.
Yeah, I know.
Would have killed the guy.
Spaghetti and buns really threw him off.
That's funny. This episode of The Imposter is sponsored by HelloFresh, the meal kit service that's dedicated to making cooking fun, easy, and convenient. Unfortunately, my gut flora isn't made of corn dogs and candy, so sometimes I get this thing called takeout fatigue. You might know the feeling. Takeout fatigue is when you've been too busy to get groceries and cook a meal for so long that you can no longer find any takeout options appetizing. Like, you might as well be looking at flooring samples to find something to eat. You can stop takeout fatigue before it starts by doing one of two things. You can quit your job, go to the woods, and try to survive off the fruits of the land like you've been wanting to do for such a long time. Or you can sign up for HelloFresh. And you can make sure that no matter what your schedule looks like, there will always be a big brown paper bag in your fridge with exactly the right portions of fresh ingredients that you need to make a delicious meal in 30 minutes or less. The people at HelloFresh come up with new healthy recipes every week, and one thing that surprised me was that even though the recipes are simple, they're adapted from such a wide range of culinary traditions that you'll never think, this tastes like a HelloFresh meal. If you want to sever your ties with takeout for a while to see how it feels, you can get 50% off your first week of HelloFresh, which can come out to as little as $6 per meal. Try it out by going to HelloFresh.ca/TheImposter and entering the promo code IMPOSTER when you subscribe. This episode of The Imposter is also brought to you by Second City. The original Second City Theater opened in Chicago in 1959, and it's become a kind of breeding ground for comedy legends like John Candy, Bill Murray, and Amy Poehler. We're kind of lucky because Toronto's got its own Second City Theater now, and if you want to experience some of the most talented improvisers and sketch comedians in this country, you should go see one of their shows. The holidays are coming up, and with it comes two distinct but potentially volatile social scenarios. There's the family hangout, or fam jam, and the office party, or social obligation that is tied to potential for upward mobility. You've got different generations in an enclosed space. Some people are bad at talking. What you need is a situation where you're enjoying something together while reducing the opportunity for things to implode. What better way to do that than to go see a comedy show? Second City can help your event run smoothly, whether you want to arrange a cocktail reception or a private performance, or if you want to book a lunch or dinner package with your show. Let them help you. Go to secondcity.com/groups. So at this point in our conversation, Mike Douse stepped out to take a call. I guess I wanted to hear like a bit of the process of FUBAR the First. One of the particular things that I remember about it is like feeling like vomiting in a couple of instances. And one of them is when Diener like slices his hand open, and my mom's a doctor, so she has a lot of like diagrams of lacerations in her office waiting room. And that looked like the kind of thing that needed stitches. Like you're like past the level of fat, but then for the rest of the film, you're wearing duct tape on it instead.
It was a poorly executed idea.
Like what? No, it was an accident that was not, we didn't execute the idea to get it taken care of.
Yeah, I guess.
We didn't plan to have that happen.
Right.
Yeah.
The other part that made me feel like vomiting was because it also felt like it referenced a lot of like physical memories of growing up in Sudbury, which was the part where people were actually fighting and that like kind of meat punching sound. And then the guy's tooth fell out. And then someone suggested that they have super glue in their car and that he could glue it back on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This guy here will fight me like this. I don't want a boring fucking brawl. I want a fucking true fight here.
Put some concrete on
I got crazy glue in my fucking car.
How did that scene get orchestrated? Like, what happened there? And these were like regular people.
Yeah, they came to us. We went into the bar, and let's be honest, you know, we weren't there so innocently. Our cameras were rolling.
Yeah.
But they came up to us and, you know, the one guy's like, hey, I want to be in your movie. And, you know.
Well, the story goes, he wanted to fight Mike Douse, who's operating.
Okay.
He wanted to fight him on film. And Mike said, well, I'm holding the camera, so you can't fight me and because I have to film it.
Why did he want to?
Just because it was like small town, kind of. I think we were kind of invading their pub. They felt the presence and they just wanted to, like, a good old boxing match. And right. Mike was a big guy and this guy was like kind of drunk and he's like, I want to fight you. Right. Like man to man. And Mike's like, cool, except I can't film it and fight you. And he's like, oh, that makes sense. Like, he appreciated that Mike was like, we can't. And so then he's like, oh, hold on. And then he went and found his buddy and he's like, why don't we fight on camera? And we're like, sounds good.
No, but he went and found like a drifter. He didn't know that guy. The guy that socked him in the mouth. Like, he didn't know this guy. He went up to like another random guy in the bar, the other biggest guy in the bar, who was just like, okay, sure. And he took his shirt off and it's like, oh God, it's Goliath. And you're just like, this guy is going to get, this drunk, happy-go-lucky, funny guy is going to get destroyed. And he did.
But they just wanted a proper, they say there's lines of dialogue. I want a proper boxing match. I want a fair fight. Like, so I think they just, the cameras kind of, they didn't know quite how to handle the cameras in their territory.
Right.
So that it,
this was the
sort
way.
Of like it digressed into like, well, maybe we can get involved. How can we get involved? Oh, well, we like to fight. Oh, that's good. Like, it just was,
I love
kind
how
of,
it like started as like an initiation for like your crew and then you somehow convinced them to have a fight.
Well, no, they came up with that once Mike explained, I can't operate and fight at the same time. And they understood that. But I'm not sure they didn't
they
know each other
like,
at all.
Put the camera
I don't know where,
down, let's fight.
They were high river boys.
When we went back to get the permissions, nobody knew who the redheaded guy was.
But he lived in the town and we found him.
What is like the amount you shot versus the amount
the
you...
The ratio was... Yeah. Around 50-1.
Okay, is that
that's pretty
crazy?
High. That's pretty high. I mean, we had like 60 hours of footage.
Okay.
We made it cut down to 80 minutes.
What was the budget of the overall film and whose credit card was that?
My credit card, we spent $12,000.
Okay.
Mostly on hair extensions and glass.
And beer.
And beer.
Were you drunk for the whole film or were you pretending to be drunk or were you like... on your way
in the scene where we did the bus shelter stuff, I was drunk at that
point. We were nervous about going out and breaking a bus shelter and so we kind of got drunk
to prepare for it.
And then the only other time I remember being drunk was camping, because that was like 3 weeks into the production. We were actually out camping.
Yeah.
But in the the stuff in between, you can't really be trashed and make a movie, because then it's like, it takes a long time.
Well, especially when you're doing everything, you know, we didn't have a crew. So,
right.
You know, you just can't be.
But yeah, camping and the bus shelter, it was like, let's let loose.
Sirens! Rifles! Firing! He made it out!
I mean, we were still in character, but it was also just like us horsing around.
Like when you threw up the next morning, you were in character.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I did. I went and changed my costume, got Mike out of his tent and said, you might want to film this. So,
okay.
And then I was like,
So in the first one, you broke the bus shelter, but that was unsanctioned?
We did clear it. Surprisingly, it was easier than it seems, because they're actually run by, the bus shelters are owned by a media company, not the city.
Oh, and they were like, break it.
Well, they get broken all the time, especially in that quadrant of the city. Like, headbangers break bus shelters. We didn't invent that. That was something that happened in the city all the time.
Okay.
So we just said, hey, we're making a student film. We'd like to break a bus shelter. And they said, which one? And then we just said, this one. They said, how many planes are you gonna break? And we're like, two
panes.
Plane of glass.
I think it's a pane.
Plane.
It's a pain when you say plane instead of pain.
Oh no!
Anyway, we broke two pieces of glass in the bus shelter.
Pieces of glass, and then we use it to
and
build
then they
another
just,
house.
And then they sent us the bill. Like, it was surprisingly easy.
How much does it cost?
It was $500, $250 a piece. But for us at the time, it was
a lot like of your budget.
Just to get that production value in the shot was like, you know.
That is 8, good to 8% know.
8% of our budget or 5% of our budget.
And they're really hard to break.
Yeah?
They don't break like you want them to.
I have a question about the things that are funny about FUBAR. So there's this one scene that's the most interesting scene to me in FUBAR 1. So you're in the car and you're on the way to a camping trip and Dean starts imitating this guy with an Indian accent or a Paki accent.
Been there, done that. been there, done that. That's the Packy who's fucking seen everything and gone everywhere.
And then Farrell, who's this like hipstery, more urbane type, is like kind of prodding Diener, and he's like,
"What's a Packy?" I don't know. Yeah, a guy from India. It sounds about right to me. Where's Pakistan?
In that moment, I kind of realized that Farrell in that film is kind of like a stand-in for the viewer, where...
Yeah, of course. He's like our foil, yeah.
Yeah, so he's like asking the film questions, essentially, yeah. Throughout, right?
That is why we were able to get away with being offensive, is because we had that foil to sort of constantly challenge us on the stupid things that we were saying.
But to the same extent, we were trying to be... Even though it was edgy, we were like trying to be a bit truthful. Like, you know, in the labor jobs we did when we were young... You know, that's the kind of chatter you would hear. Like, right. You'd hear people that were dumb and didn't know anything, like the difference between where Pakistan was and India was, and they just sort of generalized people. And,
right.
You know, so it felt like...
Thankfully, that doesn't happen anymore.
Well, it still does, but I'm just saying it was one of those edgy things, but in context is like, for the white labor guy, that conversation was not out of the ordinary. Like, kind of... And then when
Farrell dies in the film, and to me that read as kind of like... this politically correct viewer dying and like withholding their judgment and allowing themselves to just take it in.
Yeah, that's exactly how we wrote it, how we planned it.
So is the movie just telling you to like chill and laugh a little?
I don't think there was anything beyond the shock value of having Farrell die for why we wanted to kill him off. And unless, Dave, you have something else to add to that.
Well, not really. I mean, apart from the shock value, just to show that, like, we were setting up death as something that's coming inevitably, possibly for Dean's character with cancer.
Right.
And then to throw it off and be like, guess who they killed? They killed the filmmaker who's just trying to, like, film the everyman. To me, that was the gold in killing Farrell, is that we had this weight, this bed of death coming, possibly, for Diener.
Right.
And then we killed Farrell.
Okay, well, I was watching the movie with a notebook, and the way that I read it was that it was like the first FUBAR just like wanted to show all these things, and then you have the audience foil in the Farrell character, and then he dies, and then we're gonna get like sequels where there isn't a Farrell character anymore, because you know you're putting it out in the world and you're seeing how people react to it, and then now we can just like go ahead with it without kind of having this character that's interrogating it to let you off the hook in a way for what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely what... I don't know if we planned that, but then even later in the Farrell scene when we're talking about the death, we're just left on our own trying to defend his death. We were trying to, like, pull back any responsibility for this incident.
Right.
That scene does stand out because we don't have a filmmaker with us there to kind of protect us.
Yeah, that's the thing. Is like, he allows a certain kind of, like... Mm-hmm.
I never really thought about it like that, but... Layer of the film. For sure, when he dies, there's something missing for us to be more... we're more vulnerable or something without him.
Interesting. I guess fundamentally my question is, like, do you think about what your intention is in like showing this stuff? Is it to like laugh at the ignorance? Is it to laugh at the ignorance of like bangers and people with these kinds of opinions?
Yes.
Or is it to allow for a space for like white men to laugh at things you're not supposed to laugh at anymore?
I think it's the first one, where we were poking fun at these guys' ignorance, especially when the reference of like not understanding that the term someone calling someone a Paki was referring to someone from Pakistan, and Dean is like, he's from India. Like, so I think it was definitely showing the ignorance of these white laborers.
Okay. And are those people in your audience? How do they react to it?
I have some friends, a few fans that are... I believe he's from India or something like that. And he's got his nickname is based on that scene now. All his buddies. And so anyway, he was expressing that it was one of his favorite scenes ever. And that...
Wait, his nickname is based on this scene?
On the scene, yeah. I can't remember what it is. Like,
it's Binder.
No, it's like FUBAR. He's got like I can't remember it, but his buddy's like... That scene for him was something that helped him be able to like be more comfortable with all his white buddies.
Okay.
I don't know what I'm saying. I'm rambling, but I'm saying it definitely reached out. That scene had a huge impact on some young folks from India.
Right. Who are like in those.
Who are like, yeah, man, I'm glad that was like brought out, and like I have friends like that, and.
I mean, I don't know
if I'm giving you the answer that you're hoping, but I feel like it did sort of.
There's no right answer.
Loosen a bit of the like.
I think it's, there's no wrong answer.
Oh, did I say there's no right answer? That creaking noise is the sound of Michael Dowse coming back into the room.
You hit it on the head. There is no right answer.
It's true.
And we'll leave it at that.
Ask Mike about it.
What's the question?
Oh, should I ask you about it?
Sure.
Maybe you can answer for it too, Mike. Okay, do you think that FUBAR is more about making fun of ignorant people who have dumb opinions and say things like do Paki accents? Or is one of the things that it potentially does is to create a space for white men who are like woke to laugh at things they are not supposed to anymore?
White men that are, yeah, that's an interesting question. Sort of a two-parter. I think there's a bit of both in that answer for sure. I think there's a bit of a permission to laugh. I think there's it gives you a bit of permission to laugh at shit you shouldn't laugh at for sure. But I also do think it is in that, you know, I think the people that find it funny for that reasons are finding it funny because they are woke. Does that make sense? Like, because they, I don't know. That's a fucking tough question. You're overthinking this film. It's like, this is an improvised film where, I mean, I think what the appeal of these characters is that they have a ton of freedom, and the freedom isn't bought. The freedom is assumed from their, and they just don't give a shit. So I think there's a ton of like just sort of not like wish fulfillment of people just sort of enjoying watching these guys that can say whatever the fuck they want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think they do embody a certain, like, you know, freedom of speech, like where they don't care. And especially today where you got to be careful about what you say, and these guys maybe aren't. But I don't know if they embody a woke perspective of, I don't know.
There's no moral. There's no moral of the story, which is, oh, well, if you talk like Terry and Dean, you're going to get into trouble, and it's going to affect you adversely. Terry and Dean never get into trouble for speaking their minds and being somewhat racist. There's never any repercussions. So, I mean, in that sense, like I understand where your question is going. Is it, you know, creatively, you know, how responsible are you being if you're allowing these characters to, you know, I mean, me particularly, like if you look at like the TV show, both movies, I say the worst stuff, right? Like I go to places that I would never even consider as a normal human being, like in 2017. And I question it myself. I'm like, wow, am I saying this like because I want to for shock value, you know, or am I saying this because this is funny or, and it's, it's definitely something that, because there's, you know, there's a woman in a girl, an actress in a wheelchair in the TV show. And it's like, okay, so where, like, what's the boundaries of what we can say about this, you know, about this actress, right? Who's like in a wheelchair, right?
But if you can think of one instance before we leave where you were like, that's too much, we can't do that, I would love to hear.
Well,
that.
I mean, when we were cutting the first one, you know, there's this line about finger banging your cousin.
Yep.
And I was like, I'm not really sure I want that in there, you know, initially, just because I was like, that's kind of like not a nice thought. But then, you know, in hindsight, thank God it made the cut.
Yeah.
Because if I was sensitive and like didn't want to be vulnerable or embarrassed, the film would have sucked.
I mean, and it's true, so there's no like reason to hide from reality.
Okay, so we missed each other a little at the end there. When I asked Dave whether the laborers that they were portraying were in their audience, he thought I was asking whether there were brown people in the audience. But what I really wanted to know was, are the people that you're parodying part of the audience of FUBAR? And if so, what do they think? And the reason I wanted to know is that ever since the interview, I've been dwelling on this question of whether the Hoser character is playing into the idea that poor working class white people are somehow more ignorant. But I also know that FUBAR's audience isn't just rich people. It's a lot of people who would identify as the kind of guys Terry and Dean are supposed to be, and they're proud of it. And I kind of get that. But fundamentally, I wanted to know, is the audience laughing with Terry and Diener, either because they identify with them in some way, or laughing at them to get some distance, but not too much distance, from the offensive things that they're saying? So I asked resident hoser expert and FUBAR superfan John Semele to talk about it. I guess I'm curious for you, like, whether you've thought about the extent to which you're laughing at it or laughing with it when you watch it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a happy medium. I mean, to me, stuff like this, especially, you know, Canadian characters like this, especially because I'm like another white guy, it's like, you can have an affection for something and sort of laugh at it simultaneously. This is a criticism that often gets lobbed at filmmakers like the Coen brothers or something, that they're sort of condescending to their characters. But I think a lot of times what comes across as condescension is just recognizing the sort of failures or foibles or sheer stupidity or lunacy of characters precisely because you know them so well.
Mm-hmm.
I should say as a caveat that, like, I count myself as a fan of FUBAR, which sort of clouds my critical judgment of it in a certain way. But I always think that, like, even when they're making these jokes that are very far, it's not mean-spirited. Like, even the ostensibly, like, problematic jokes in the new series, the jokes are always equally on the fact that, like, these guys are so oblivious and kind of dumb, which is itself a kind of mean-spiritedness, I suppose. But like, I don't think that they trouble me in the same way that they might coming from different characters. I guess because like you go through it and you see how sort of like weirdly loving and gentle they are throughout this sort of various movies and shows. But then again, I'm like squarely in the target demographic. So I'm like the last person who would ever conceivably be offended by it.
That was John Semele, who sits squarely in the target demographic for a very niche subgenre of films that are made for white men. You also heard from Carla Gardy and Shelley Zhang, Dave Lawrence and Paul Spence, or Terry and his buddy Dean, and Mike Douse, who is not about to put down the camera no matter how much you want to fight. You can find links to the latest iteration of the FUBAR franchise, FUBAR The Age of Computer, and dig deeper into the Dictionary of Canadianisms on Historical Principles at canadalandshow.com/imp. This episode of The Imposter was produced by Angela Shackle and I, with assistance from Ali Graham. Our managing editor is Kevin Sexton, and our theme music is by Nathan Burley. You can follow us on Twitter at Imster, that's I-M-P-S-T-R, and you can follow me at Aliyah Pavani. Our crowdfunding site is patreon.com/CanadaLand, and if you like The Imposter, tell your people about it.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.